Remember when I told you about True Diagnostics' True Age test? The True Age test provides comprehensive results. With a simple at-home kit, True Age analyzes hundreds of thousands of markers on your DNA to reveal your true biological age and how fast you're aging compared to normal. By the way, up to 90% of aging is driven by lifestyle and environment, not just genetics, which means knowing this info gives you the power to improve. With True Age, you'll also get a breakdown of over 75 key longevity biomarkers. Things like metabolic health, immune response, and even risk factors for certain conditions. What I love is that True Diagnostic doesn't just give you data, they give you guidance. Along with your results, you'll receive personalized recommendations, basically anti-aging biohacks tailored to you to help you improve those numbers and even potentially reverse your biological age over time. It's like getting a roadmap to age better. And the best part, it's super easy and convenient. The True Age test is done at home, no doctor visits or big needles, just a quick painless finger prick. This is important to me, as I always get a bit weak-kneed when I see the nurse line up a bunch of vials. You send off the tiny sample in a prepaid package, and in about 2 to 3 weeks, you'll get a detailed online report about your aging and health, fast and hassle-free. If you're serious about longevity or just curious about what your body's real age is, head over to truediagnostic.com and use my code MINDFUL to get 20% off your entire order. This is your chance to take control of your aging and make every year count more for your health. Visit truediagnostic.com and use code MINDFUL at checkout to get 20% off.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
The thing about a cult is, the distinguishing marks of a cult is that it actively works to stop your thinking so that you're no longer free to question. I mean, take Dostoevsky's attitude towards religion. He said, it's so important to me to believe in Christ, even though I'm filled with doubt. I'm like the guy who came to Jesus and said, I believe, Lord, help my unbelief. But such people, Dostoevsky or that guy in the New Testament, you're free to believe whatever you want. Nobody's trying to make you.
Paul Cook, thanks for joining me on the Mindful Movement podcast today.
Thank you, Les. I appreciate it.
I was kind of excited to see when you reached out via email. I had never really received an email quite like yours. I was like, well, this could be fun. You sent me an email that you have a memoir that you're working on, and it details your experience in a cult of some. And I was like, well, that is interesting. So I was looking forward to chatting with you and hearing the story. What made you want to reach out to me to tell your story, Paul?
I think that everyone in our culture is interested in understanding how people arrive at their major life decisions, because we all have to make them. Sometimes in making you are very concerned about, I think, how one deals with stress and frustration and mistakes. I thought, well, this is something that I've learned to deal with in my own way, but your audience, I think, is attracted to ways that one can find peace in the midst of the struggles of life. And so I thought, well, I've had that experience. I thought, well, maybe the Mindful Movement would find my experience something that was sympathetic of it, sort of went together with what you're up to. So that's why I sent it.
Well, let's take us back to the beginning. I mean, maybe you could shed a little insight, if you'd like, of kind of life before the cult, and then lead us into how did you move in that direction? What was it like during? And then what came of it?
Well, thank you. I'm glad to talk about it. I was very young. I'm now 75. I was 19 when I dropped out of Brown University to look for the truth. I was inspired by a couple of things. I had read Hermann Hesse's Siddhartha, which is sort of a fictional take on the life of Buddha. And, you know, you sit under a tree until you get enlightened. So I thought, that's for me. Because I was 19 and thinking, all I need is the right tree. But that did not work out. And another figure that attracted me, and that was the figure of Jesus. And I'd read something by Khalil Gibran about Jesus having returned to the world, and no one recognized him, and he was rejected, just like the first time. And I thought, well, I hope I wouldn't be that way or rejected. So I'm from a Jewish family, so the idea of Jesus appealing to me was not something that was particularly popular with my mom and dad. But I returned, I'd heard that Jesus had been a carpenter. And so I said, well, if I become a carpenter, something good. I heard about Siddhartha, and I wanted to go that way. And then I heard about Jesus, I would go that way. So because my Jewish background was very nominal, we were Jewish, but only in the most culturally tribal way, but not really religiously. And I think a lot of American Jews are in that boat. I returned to my hometown of Houston and got a job as a carpenter's apprentice. And I met an old carpenter who began telling me about Jesus. And he was an old man. I'd never heard an old man talk that way before. And he also talked about how much he loved his wife and how wonderful she was. And I'd never heard an old man do that either. So I paid attention to him. And we both were moved on to other jobs. I was with the Carpenter Union Apprentice Program. So I never saw him again. But then I met another carpenter. And I wasn't eating meat at the time because I had been reading Gandhi's autobiography. And Gandhi was not eating meat. He was a vegetarian. So I said, I want to imitate Gandhi because I think something good might happen to me if I do that. So a fellow carpenter said, well, why don't you eat meat? And I said, well, I told him about Gandhi. He said, well, Jesus ate meat. And I said, well, really? And I was always interested in hearing something about Jesus. So the carpenter told me about Jesus. And he said, why don't you come to church with me on Sunday? And I said, I'm Jewish. Jews don't go to church. But he was gentle and persistent. And so finally I said, okay, I'll meet you at your church. I hardly recognized him. Instead of his overalls, he was wearing a suit and tie. But I went to church, and one thing led to another, and over the next 10 days, I was converted to Christianity, and it was a serious decision and a real conversion. And I started going to the church, and I came home for Thanksgiving to talk to my parents. They were living in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I was in Houston, and they were very upset by my conversion. I wished I could make them understand, but I was about to have something happen that would upset them a whole lot more. Because I went back to Houston. The pastor of the church was going to India for a Christian mission, and he asked a young couple in the church to keep an eye on me while he was away. So I came to church. It was December 7th, 1969. I was now 20 years old. And they said, oh, we heard about the hippie Christians that are parked out in that are camped out in the park west of Houston. Did you see it? It was in the Houston Chronicle yesterday. And I said, no, I didn't see it. So, well, we're going to go visit them. It's wintry, and we're going to take them some winter clothes and some toys for their kids. There's about 100 of them we saw on the paper. You want to come? I said, sure. So I went with them to the park outside of Houston, and I was not expecting anything much, but I was just blown away because they were living communally. They looked like radicals and hippies, and this is December 1969. The guys looked like a take on Che Guevara, except the only thing different was they were Christian. They had little Bibles and they quoted it. And they said, all that are really religious, really Christian, live communally. And they showed me a verse in the Bible that said, all that believe were together and had all things common. They said, most of the Christians in the world don't do that because they're compromised, but we're not. And I said, wow, I never knew that. And then he said, and look here. And he showed me another verse that said that if you're a real disciple, you have to forsake everything. And I said, wow, I didn't know that. He says, well, that's what we've done. So meanwhile, the couple that had brought me out from the church were beginning to get a little nervous. They were not buying all this, but I was, though I wasn't sure that I was. I was just really thinking. They didn't have much to say. So we drove home, and I didn't say much at all. But all that evening, I was thinking about it. And the next day at work as a carpenter's apprentice, I was thinking about it. And by the time the day was over, I decided I was going to join them. Now, the fact that in this particular gig as a carpenter, we were taking down the ceiling of the Astro Hall, which was next to Houston's Astro Dome. And the ceiling, where I had my hands above my head like 6 hours a day. We're there, Ada, taking down these things, and it was covered with dust. And I've been doing it for 2 weeks. I was tired of it. And, of course, I wasn't thinking, you know, what a great way to get out of doing that, you know. But that was part of the influence, but that wasn't the real reason. But so I learned a lesson from this, ultimately, thinking back on it, because I'm thinking back 50 years, that when you're about to make a big decision, don't do it impulsively. You know, think about it. Talk to a few friends about it. I didn't talk to anybody. But that night, after work, I went home. And I got my gear, my Bible, and a few things, sleeping bag, and threw it into the back of the car and drove out there. And I joined. And it was really difficult. I'll tell you one anecdote. The people were very nice, except they said, if you really want to join, you can't sleep in the tent with all the other single guys. You have to sleep outside. It was cold and wet. I had my car. You can sleep in your car for the night, and we'll test you, see if you're really up to it. And then one of the guys said, you know what happens when a red ant gets into a black ant bed? And I said, no. And he said, they kill it. And I said, He said, no, we're not going to kill you, brother, but we're going to find out whether you belong with us or not. And that kind of freaked me out. But then another guy, who was a black guy from Canada, took me to the leader. And he was not the real leader. He was a sub-leader. And he was a really nice guy, really friendly. And he said, is there anything you want to talk about? And I said, well, one of the other guys said something that kind of scared me about red ants and black ants. He said, don't worry about that. He's just being tough, you know. We're not, he said, love casts out all fear. Don't be afraid. And so I spent the night there, and then the next day they let me sleep in the tent. And there were about 100 people. There were children, there were couples. And so began my life as a member of the Children of God. The press called us the Green Berets of the Jesus people, and so on and so forth. And I was very committed. I was a completely true believer.
So they called themselves the Children of God.
Well, actually, that came from the first name that I knew of them was the Revolution for Jesus. But it was the press who called us the Children of God. And, of course, it sounded good, and it stuck.
Interesting. So prior to this, it seemed like you were, like, looking, like, you were, I mean, humans are very malleable, especially when we're young. You were looking for some role model to follow. Like, you were reading these books, and everything you heard, you liked. Like, you were searching for something, which is, you know, common for most people when they're young and they're trying to find their place in the world and want to fit in. Did you feel like you didn't fit in your family or structure or community structure? Was there like pressure built up where you were searching for something already, like at least subconsciously that you could see now in hindsight?
Yes, I think that was a good question. As far as my home life goes, my parents both had difficult childhoods, quite difficult. And I think they were very busy when they began a family, still dealing with their own backgrounds. And so they didn't have a lot of time. In some way, I was unraised. They left me to my own devices a lot. They loved me the best they could, but they were unable to really be involved with my life the way, say, my wife's parents were involved in her life. You know, I'd come home from school. My mother would be resting in her bedroom with the door closed. She would come out to fix dinner and stuff. She had a difficult childhood herself, very difficult. And my father, too. He was an immigrant. So when I went off to college, I was glad to get away from home, and I was looking for something. I was looking for a family in a way, but I didn't know it. I think I was looking for mothering in a way, real consistent loving mothering. And I loved my father, but he was so distracted by his work and by other things that he rarely had a lot of time for me. On occasion, he really came through for me, but he just wasn't aware. He was so busy with his own life. So, yes, I was looking for a community. That's true. I was looking for a family. And that was part of the appeal. But it's not reducible to that. It's not just simply I was missing, and that was, I was looking for the best way to serve Christ, because that had really made a difference. So these things merged, and I found the Children of God to be, I thought I'd found what I was going to do for the rest of my life. And I think that many people in the group, now there are not too many people in the group were from such an educational background as I was from. I went to Ivy League school from Houston and all that sort of thing. But I didn't finish it. I dropped out in the middle of my sophomore year. And I came from it. My parents were educated, and they were, you know, it was sort of a cerebral household as much as it, in some way. But
so when you were welcomed into this community, did you get the impression that they considered themselves like a cult, or is it just like happy community? And well, maybe there's really no difference. I don't know. Like, I don't know what really defines a cult.
Well, here's the thing. Jesus said, beware of wolves in sheep's clothing. Now, if you're a wolf and you really want to disguise yourself as a sheep, you've got to do a pretty good job, or people are going to see, like the story of Little Red Riding Hood, they're going to see a fang, what big teeth you have. So the teeth have to be really well hidden. And, you know, the wolf's nose, the disguise has to be really good. And so you're not going to recognize that there's something fishy if you're just a 20-year-old kid that doesn't know very much. And I didn't even meet the real leader. The guy who comforted me the night I joined, Big Josh was his name, was truly a nice guy. I didn't know that he was the leader. I thought he was the real leader. Now, I heard there was a Moses, and I figured, you must be Moses. And he laughed and said, no, I'm Joshua, which is, you know, Moses, second in command. So 3 weeks later, we moved to another car. And when we got there, it was like the whole caravan, like 30 vehicles, a mile-long caravan on the freeway. We pulled into this park on Lake Houston, and there was a guy in a clearing wearing a Russian sort of hat, in, like a wagon master, telling us where to park the cars. I knew instantly that must be Moses. He was a little guy, maybe 5'7", 5'6". I'm 6'1". But then about a week later, he came and I didn't see him after that. He came and spoke to us late at night in the tent. And there was something really charismatic about him. And he said, look at you. You've forsaken all to live for Jesus. You are really living the Bible like the early church. You are the resurrection of the early church, living for him with all your hearts. You're not compromised. You're not working for anybody but him. This has all made us feel really good. And he was good about that. He was really good about making us feel that we were special. And I think there's a certain desire. Here, this is the generation, you know, I think it was Christopher Lash wrote a book of it, used the illustration of the pig and the python. Demographically, the baby boom generation, wherever, as it went through the python of time, when we went to elementary school, you know, all the elementary schools in the United States had to build more to take care. We went to high school, there was more. Went to college because we were such a big group of kids. And as when there's a lot of people, how do you distinguish yourself from others? How do you make yourself feel special so that you're not just like one of the crowd? So I think there's a certain desire to be regarded as important, as, you know, who is it that Jesse Jackson would have poor black kids say, I am somebody, I am special. And if you say that enough, you begin to believe it. Well, that hunger does not exist only among poor African-American kids. It existed in my generation, the desire to be special. So I felt I had joined a community that was very special, that we were, this was the end time, that the return of Christ was, you know, only a few decades away, and we were living for him with all our hearts, and we were showing the world how Christians ought to really live. So there was nothing dark or that made me question any of it, except it seemed that certain things were a little harsh, and in a certain way, the group tried to fulfill certain things that were in the Bible, which were natural, but you didn't. For example, Jesus said that a man's foes will be of his own household. He that loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. So my parents, when they finally figured out where I was, because I didn't tell them much, and they came to visit me 2 or 3 weeks after I joined, they drove from Baton Rouge to Houston, and they found the park because they talked to the pastor. Well, my pastor found me first. He came out and tried to persuade me that I needed to think for myself. And the group said, he's just a member of the established church, they're compromised, churchianity. You don't want, here they are, you've made a decision to live fully for the truth, and they're just trying to get you to compromise and come back and live like them because you convict them. And I said, yeah, that's right. So Joe was actually a nice guy. I was sort of hard on him because the group had told me he will try to persuade you to come to quit. And so they said the same thing about my parents. Your parents, if they show up, will try to persuade you to quit. Well, sure enough, my parents did show up. And I was already programmed, so to speak, because I'd memorized that passage that a man's foe shall be of his own house. And so I was hard on my mom and dad. And, you know, I was already had some issues with them. So that was, and so this was not just with me. A lot of us had the same issue. And eventually, a year or so later, my father was so frustrated with the whole thing that instead of giving up on me, he organized a group called FreeCog, Free Our Children from the Children of God, and hundreds of parents joined. So the problem is that we lacked, there was a lot of anger and frustration, but sometimes there was really a lack of love for people that didn't share our commitments, you know? And that's really actually not a Christian attitude. My father, well, he came out to visit us in our big community. We finally found a place out in West Texas where there were eventually 200 or 300 of us lived as the group began to grow. Because eventually this group started with 100 people when I joined, and it began with just a few. By the time I left, there were 8,000 people in the group.
Can I stop you, Paul, and just clarify something? What was their pitch? Like you mentioned a moment ago that, you know, like you've chosen to live like fully for the truth or something. Like, what were they trying to tell you to do? To just disassociate from the rest of civilization, be self-sustaining so that you could like worship without any distraction? Or what was so different about what they're offering?
Well, they took a fundamental sort of evangelical Christianity and married it to late 1960s political radicalism. And the sort of energy and anger and commitment that was, you know, the Weather Underground and SDS was married to the notion of evangelical Christianity, where we have the gospel, we have the truth, we want to share it, we have the New Testament, that's our guidebook. And so that combination was very attractive in 1969 and throughout the 70s. So the pitch was, here's the scriptures. Most people are only following a little bit of it. They're not really committed like the way the early Christians were 2,000 years ago. We are. So the pitch was, if it's worth doing it all, it's worth doing with all your heart. And a lot of people are looking for something to do with all their hearts. So that was the pitch. The pitch was, you believe in Jesus? You really want to serve him? Here we are. Come join. And that was sort of the idea of the Jesus movement of the late 60s, early 70s. And the Children of God, our leader, I should tell you about him in a second, said, we are the founders of the Jesus movement. Well, maybe or maybe not. I'm not sure. There was a recent movie about that. But this man came from a family of, I guess you'd call them mavericks. And his mother had been like him. And he learned all these things from his mother about not taking the religious institutions, the Christian institutional world as the true definition of Christianity. She started her own evangelical movement. She had a big building in Miami, and somehow or other she got disinvited from leading that, even though she founded it, and she went off on her own, and her son eventually became her assistant. And he was then helping another evangelical guy get his show on TV, but he quit doing that. And he was 49 years old. He had really only his four children and his wife and their spouses. And he was committed to being an evangelical Christian of sorts. And then his mother, who had retired, was living in Huntington Beach, California. And she said, you know, the hippies and radicals and servicemen who have left the service are just hanging around here. And I found that I go down to the beach with peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. I can talk to them about Jesus. I think they need you. And so he came out to Huntington Beach in 68 and realized that this was to be his future, that he knew how to reach radicals and he started wearing a beret and sunglasses and taking on this whole kind of radical look, and at the same time adding in the whole Christian gospel. There was one other problem, though. Underneath, he had already compromised, because sort of on his own, he'd begun visiting prostitutes and had all kinds of appetites regarding sex, which he kept underground. But once the group took off, some of the leaders in the group, he began sharing that with them and teaching them that he believed that if you were a real Christian, you were free from the law and you could indulge in that as long as it was done in love. And that, I've since realized, this is the Achilles heel of most of these cult leaders, is that when you get enough power, if you have any inclination in that direction at all, you will use it to take advantage of human sexual nature. And in the case of a Christian outfit, eventually, in my view, it was our undoing. Though he tried to get us all to agree with him, and me too, toward the last 2 years in the group, at least the last 1 year, I got stuck into that too.
Yeah, that's part of the, like, I guess the myth of culture here, that it all goes well and then the leader convinces you that they get to have sex with everyone they want to in the cult.
Yes, and so if the leader has something kinky or selfish or crass or mean or power hungry or whatever, like, if you give him the opportunity of having enough power, like Lord Acton's dictum, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So you give a cult leader, you know, doesn't answer to anybody. That's another thing you have to look out for. Leadership that is unchecked, that there's nobody around to say no to him or her, because sometimes it can be a woman, that tends to be dangerous. I mean, the founders had it right, that checks and balances are the only way, because human nature, whether it's in New England or America, early America, or anywhere on earth, human nature, it tends to be, if you give it a chance, to be selfish.
we're capable as a species of doing such beautiful things, motivated by love and curiosity and creativity, and we are also capable of very dark things.
I mean, you said it.
And, you know, you see it out in nature in different ways too, but humans just, we are unique. We come with a lot of good, bad, ugly. What, like, you were in there for almost a decade. Like, what's a day in the life? Like, what does it look like?
Good. Well, I'll tell you, my first attempt at a memoir was written when I was at Brown. After I got out of the group, I went back to, and after 2-3 years of sort of being very confused, I went back to school, and Brown took me back, which was very generous of them. I have to give them credit for that. And I was there for 2 years finishing my bachelor's degree. And in the last year, I wrote a memoir, which was focused on the middle year of my 9 years. And during that year, I was in Florida, and I was in charge of a little team of about 6 people, and we wandered all over Florida handing out our literature. And we believed the literature, these were all letters that our leader had written to us about the Christian life. And these letters could be very charming. And he had great illustrators. You know, by then there were 7,000-8,000 people in the group. And among them, there were some very talented artists who were helping him put together these letters and mailing them out to all of, we had, by then there were several hundred communes all over the country. We had a little mobile commune. We had an old Ford panel truck and the 6 of us wandering around Florida.
So you're trying to recruit. This is like a recruiting process.
No, at this point, we weren't so much trying to recruit as get out, or if someone wanted to join us, they could. In fact, there were once, especially a young girl wanted to join us, but she was only 17. And my rest of my team wanted to say, she wants to be with us. Why don't you let her join? I said, Mo, that's our nickname for our leader. Mo said, don't do that. You take somebody underage and you get in trouble fast. So this girl was crying. I said, please, I want to go with you. And I said, I'm sorry, but you can write us and we'll keep in touch with you, but you can't go with us. And I remember one of the girl on the team was very upset with me because I wouldn't take her. But we were mostly getting out the Mo letters. That's an important aspect of the group. The leader realized, David Berg was his name. He was 49 when he founded the group, started the group, and he started it mostly with his four adult children who were, they were the ones who attracted other people to the group. And then their father sort of did his thing. And that's the people that I first met, you know, these people that his children had attracted. They were radical looking and hippie looking, and I liked that. But by the time 1974, we were traveling around. Finally, the leader went off to Europe to find more places for our communes to be. And he took his mistress with him, though we didn't know that. She was his secretary. And he said, anybody who thinks otherwise is dirty-minded. But actually, she was his mistress. And so he realized that in order to keep in touch with us and to govern the group, he needed to write us letters. So at first they were just letters to his lieutenants. But after a while, he realized that everybody needed to hear from him. So he began writing these letters of counsel and advice about all kinds of things. And they were very entertaining and amusing, and they were illustrated. And he always showed himself as a lion, a very friendly lion, who looked like a human being, you know. It's sort of a mix of C.S. Lewis's Aslan and I don't know what else. And these letters, he told us, were God's word for today. And we believed it. And there's a long story about how that happened. But what my little road team was doing was handing these out for donations. People say, give them somebody. So we get up in the morning and we found a place. For example, in Orlando, we found a little hotel, motel, and we said, we're Christian missionaries, we're handing out our literature, and we don't have much money. Would you put us up for a week? And, you know, the guy said, yeah. So whenever we were in Orlando, we stayed there for a week, and we had a place like that in St. Pete and a place like that in Daytona, and we just traveled around the state. And if we didn't, we'd sleep on the beach. And so we did that for 9 months, handing out the literature, and we had people who wanted to join us, and we would sometimes talk to them about the Lord. But mostly we handed out the literature. And every day we would get together in the morning and we'd pray. And we'd ask God to help us do what we had to do. And at the end of the day, we would pray again. And the thing that was so charming about it was that we were friends and we had something in common. We were dedicated to what we were doing. We believed we were doing God's work. If we didn't believe that, it would have been ridiculous. It would have been, looking at it from the outside, it would look like a horrible waste of time.
Were there any other, like, rituals other than the praying? Any other?
No,
were there drugs involved?
Or? No drugs at all, no. And no sex either until the very end. We lived like really strict church boys and girls. But what there was reading Moe's letters was part of a liturgy. And later, after I left the group, you know, Jesus only gave his church two ordinances, baptism and communion. The Catholics believe there are more, the marriage and there's the last rites and all those things that they've added in. But the New Testament itself only says, Jesus only said, when people believe, you baptize them, and then you remember what I did on the cross by having communion. You take the bread and you take the wine. Well, in the children of God, neither of those things was taught much of. There was rarely ever a baptism. In my 9 years, I never witnessed a baptism in the children of God. And furthermore, there was never communion, though once or twice Mo mentioned it. But the second time was horrible, in as much as he used it as a way of illustrating sexual communion. I mean, he essentially, it was blasphemous, really. He took this sacred thing of remembering what Christ did for us and used it to apply to encourage us to have sex with each other. So, but this was at the very end. So we read the Moe letters, we prayed, we talked about what happened that day, people that we met and had conversations with, but mostly it was handing out the literature. This is the middle. In the very beginning, it was just go down to Sunset Strip in LA or the beach Huntington Beach or go to Griffith Park in LA and just with a little Bible, like this, I still read a little Bible like this. You talk to people on the beach about their souls. But that changed. And the thing about the handing out the literature was that it not only made us feel like we were doing God's work, but it brought in money. And that money supported the work for the next 4 or 5 years until we started going to countries where we couldn't.
So everybody sustained themselves. Like, you weren't engaged in any local economies. It was really just the donations from handing out literature.
Yeah. And we were young. And in the beginning, we didn't hand out literature until 72. So in the beginning, it was just when someone joined, they gave whatever they had. Every now and then you'd meet somebody who had a lot. Most of us had nothing. All I had was a set of carpenter tools and $200 in the bank. But a lot of people had, not a lot, but some people had a house. They gave that. Some people gave us, a guy in East Texas gave us the use of his of an old property that he had. Two people in Texas. So that's how we did it until late 72 when we started handing out the literature. And then it was quite a propaganda machine. A lot of these letters went out and a lot of money began coming in. So that unwittingly or unconsciously, we were had found a new way to support our movement.
So how did you, like, what's the process of getting out of this? Like, did you, how were you able to self-reflect or be objective when you were in it? Like, how did the fish see the water?
Good question. Well, early on, for example, it must have been 72, Mo wrote a letter called Old Bottles about how people resist change. Jesus said, you don't put new wine in old bottles. Meaning in New Testament time, bottles were actually made of animal skins. And if you had an old brittle one and you put new wine in it, the acidity of the wine would burst, would make the bottle break. So Mo said, my letters are the new wine. And if you're an old bottle, you can't handle it. And so when something new came down the pipe, for example, he told us at one point that the comet Kohoutek, which was coming towards the Earth in 1973, was the harbinger of the end of America. And we all had to get out of America. And if that you couldn't handle that, then you should leave. So we all believed it. So a lot of us left America. And there's a few of us, most said, some of you are called to stay. I felt that I was called to stay. And later that same notion, he said, all people that have been in so long and all they do is read the Bible and they don't read my letters, they're old bottles. You know, the new wine is my letters, and you should read them. So I didn't want to be an old bottle. And then the sex thing came down the pike. If that's too much for you, you don't realize what it means to be a revolutionary Christian. Obviously, you don't have what it takes, and I wanted to have what it took.
What was the idea there to increase the population through, I mean, was the sex associated with getting more people?
No, it was not. I mean, there certainly were a lot of kids born, and those kids suffered the most in the long run. I left after the 10th year of the group, but the group went on and on. And when those kids started growing up, they got really mixed up in all kinds of stuff. And most of the memoirs that have been written about the children of God have been written by the children who were born in the group. My memoir, I was somebody in the group who left early on. I mean, the group went on and on and on.
Is it still around?
Yes, it's still around, and then as it's changed its name, it changed from the Children of God, it became the Family of Love, and now it's the Family International. And if you go to their website, it looks like a nice Christian group, and it's wolf in sheep's clothing. Mo is no longer alive. His mistress is now runs the show. She is regarded as a prophetess. There are still people in it, you know, some of them from the earliest days. But a huge group of people left, I don't know, maybe 2,000.
Do they do good? Are they active in some type of community service? Or?
Well, yeah, they do stuff. They arrange for Thanksgiving dinners. But it's mostly PR, I think. But the thing is, well, the sex thing began to cause problems. And for me, I was in Chile, in South America. And by then, we were not handing out literature that much because our literature was controversial. So we were working. It was the first time I'd ever worked since I joined the group. I was teaching English. And I was going to teach somebody an English lesson. He worked for the Chilean Copper Company. And I saw on a marquee in downtown, sort of a ticker tape marquee, that a group of communal living people had just committed mass suicide in Guyana. And it was the first I'd ever heard of the People's Temple, Jim Jones. But it shocked me. And I went to the newsstands later that week and picked up the Newsweek with all the pictures, you know, with the almost empty tub full of the cyanide-laced Kool-Aid. That's where the saying, drink the Kool-Aid, comes from. And read about how that group did itself in. The group called their leader, Jim Jones, they called him Dad. Well, the Children of God's leader, we called him Dad. And they all lived in one big commune, you know, 980 people. Well, we broke up into little communes, but in the beginning, we had two big ones, one in L.A. and one in West Texas. And the one in West Texas once had over 200, so I knew what it was like to live. But I said, no, there are some similarities, but no, we're not like that. Then about 2 weeks later, our leader sent us a letter, one of his memo letters, in which there was a picture from one of our good artists, very fine illustrators. All the dead bodies of Jonestown were on the cover, drawn, you know, in pen and ink. And from each body came a lightly drawn spirit going up with arms outraised, with joyous faces to heaven. That was the cover. I said, that's odd. Because that's not how I saw what I read. Now, usually we were skeptical about what you read in Newsweek or Time. But, I mean, it was just the bare fact. Then, in the letter itself, he said, Jim Jones and his people took the only way out they had. They were harassed, driven to this by the U.S. government, which persecuted them and drove them out of America, and then was bombing them in Guyana. And for the first time in my 9 years or 8 3/4 years of the group, I took a long sideways glance at Mo, figuratively. I don't know if you can hear, that's our cat.
We have a cat going on, yeah.
That's our calico cat. She sometimes yowls. I said, that can't be. This can't be anything good. This was not, there's nothing good about what happened there. And I don't believe it. I mean, we were very left-wing. We were very anti-American. We were like, the whole 1619 project. Mo would harp on the injustices done to the Indians, which were real. And the injustices done to African Americans, which were real. But there was also some good things about the founding of America, but we didn't get into that. And so Mo's letters were consistently beating the drum. He said, we believe everything the communists believe except Jesus. We believe in Jesus, but we're communists. And he was very, very anti-American stuff. So, but this, I just didn't believe it. For about 24 hours after that, we always read the old letters together in our colonies. We called our houses colonies. For about 24 hours after it was read, I was in a state of, I'd never been in before. I was wandering around thinking, if this isn't where I'm supposed to be, where am I going to go? What am I going to do? I've given almost a decade of my, I was suddenly drifting. It was a very strange experience. In a way, it was liberating because the whole future opened up, because I thought I was going to spend my whole life, and I was only 29 years old, with the group. And suddenly I thought, if this is really where we're at, I can't trust Mo. But I was so committed to the group that after 24 hours, I got distracted. There was a woman that I was involved with, because Mo said you should get involved with women and witness to them about Jesus when you're sleeping with them and all that sort of stuff. So there was a Chilean woman that I was involved with. So actually she was very good to me and very friendly, and she distracted me and I was busy teaching English. And so I tried not to think about it for at least 2 weeks. Then we got another Mo letter. Mo said, everyone thinks that we're like Jonestown. Go home and show your parents that we're not like that, and show your loved ones. Get a round trip ticket. But just leave your their address so that we can send you the latest Mo letters and then come back. And when I heard that, I said, that very day I called my parents. They sent me the money for a round trip ticket, and I bought it. Now, I would not admit to myself that I was leaving, but the Chilean woman that I was with, she said her son, she had a teenage son, she was divorced, and he wanted me to buy him a pair of blue jeans. And then when I came back, I said, he was going to give me some money. I said, don't give me any money because, if I get a chance, I'll buy some blue jeans and I'll bring them back for you, what size you wear. And then you can pay me. He said, okay.
So I wouldn't. You knew you were coming back.
I knew that was, is, I said that without even admitting it to myself that I wasn't going to come back. Because Because backsliders, that's what it was called. It was the thing I dreaded most. I never wanted, and anybody who thought about it was, nobody talked their doubts. Doubts were, voicing your doubts was verboten. And so it all had to be done. I didn't tell anybody how I was feeling, and I couldn't even tell it to myself. I have a chapter in my memoir called Why I Tiptoed Out of the Children of God. And it was not because I wanted to wake anybody else up to what I was doing, because I didn't want to wake myself up. It was so, I was so self, I had so internalized the loyalty I had to the group that I could not admit, I was ashamed to admit that I might not be coming back. But when I got on the plane and it took off from the Santiago airport, I felt this sense of this weight fell off of me. I didn't know what the future was going to be, but I knew that I needed to have a break. And one thing led to another. And I mean, I was going to come back. I had a round trip ticket. And just before I was to come back, I got sick with hepatitis.
How convenient.
I really did get sick. I couldn't do it. And then I was well 3 weeks later, and I called the company that was to reschedule. It was a charter company. They'd gone out of business. My return trip ticket was no longer good.
Do you think your body got sick to protect you?
Well, I think that's right. I think that this is what Christians would call providence. That is, the Lord said, you ain't going back, buddy. You just stay right in bed for a week or two. And the airline going out of business, that too. I didn't realize at the time. It was like, you know, I do believe in God and in the Bible. And I believe the Lord said, I think you've learned your lesson. I didn't want you doing that, but you did it. And so now don't be like a dog going back to his vomit. But I didn't think that. But now looking back, and I knew some people in the group. I had a friend who I loved, and he had a wife and kids, and he was very talented. He was a leader in the group, and he left, and the group called him. One of Mo's daughters called him and said, we need you. God wants you. You're leaving your plow in the field. You know, you were serving the Lord. And he went back in. He left his wife and kids and went back in and stayed in another 15 years. Yeah.
I want to know a little bit how you thinking back on the whole experience. But before, Paul, when you got out and you reconnect with your family, what was it like coming back into your family? I assume they were all really happy.
Good question. Yes. And yet they never rubbed it in. My father never said, I told you so. In fact, one time he said to me, this was 5 years, 6 years, he said, you know, I fought you so hard. I formed FreeCog, but you know, I think it was probably good for you. It made you more serious. It made you less willing to tolerate bullshit. It made you mature. You're different from other people because you've been through that. You're not going to be as fooled as easily. I hope it was right. But the point I want to make is that my old man, instead of being bitter or angry or rubbing it in, was actually very gracious and saying, you know, it was not a good thing, but maybe in some way it was. And, you know, he lived another 10 years after I left the group. I felt like I could make it. I had a chance to make it up to him. And I had a really good relationship with my dad and my mom too. And when I first came home, they didn't ask me any questions. It was, what are you up to? What are you going to do? A girl I knew in high school, I got mixed up with her, and I was not a good bet for a husband. I wasted her time, but she certainly kept me from, she distracted me, you know, she was good to me. And so my parents and this girl, and then there were other people who had left the group, and I went to talk to them. I met some of them. And for the first time with people that I knew in the group, they talked their doubts. And that was so, it was so weird, because when you knew each other in the group, everybody was always positive. There was never a word of doubt. They said, you know, I think Mo's a fraud. They thought that stuff like that. He claimed to be God's prophet. He's a false prophet. So he's a pervert. I couldn't believe I was hearing these things. You know, I thought them myself, but I couldn't believe. But when I heard them say it, you know, And some of these people were higher up in the group than me, and they knew more about the internal workings of the leadership. And when they voiced these doubts, that helped me adjust. And then after I'd been home for about 3 months, I got a phone call from a mid-level leader who had been visiting our colony in Santiago. And I'd left my phone number and everything the boss had to do. He called me and said, "How's it going?" And when I realized who it was, I think that was the first time I realized, you're not in charge of me anymore. I don't have to answer to you. And I did not. And I realized after I hung up, I'm done, you know. But he called up and I was defensive. I said, "Well, I got sick, you know, and I'm earning money to buy a ticket to come back. My ticket was voided." I pretended everything was fine. But when the phone call was over, I said, "I'm glad it was over." And I realized how much I resented his phone call. Because he was just trying to, I mean, he thought he was doing the right thing. He was not a bad guy in that sense, but he was part of it. And I didn't want to go back. But it still took me, I think I was not fully over it for a whole year. I had dreams for a while about being back in one commune or another. And there were people I loved who were in the group, who I cared about.
Did you ever reach out to any of them and say, "You got to get out"?
No.
Do you feel like the way you paused there, do you feel like guilty or ashamed about that? Or is it just like everybody's got to learn their own way?
No, it's because I knew when I was in the group, when someone tried to tell me, every now and then I'd meet somebody like in Houston. I was once in Houston. This was in the middle of the time I was in the group. I met somebody who had dropped and who left the group, and he tried to tell me that the group was all wet. And I thought, "You backslider, you know, you compromise, you're a compromiser." And I realized that that's how people in the group would think of me. You have to already have, now when there were people who had left the group, I talked to them and we encouraged each other. But now there was one guy, a sweet young guy who I'd known in the group, and he wrote me a letter saying, praising the group and saying, "This is the year of the prodigal son. Mo says all those who left should come back. I just wanted to know, we miss you. We hope you'll come back." And I didn't even reply. And I don't feel guilty about it because I know it just fuels the machine, because people are taught that backsliders are, you shouldn't listen to them. So, but maybe I should have. Maybe my memoir is a very late attempt to make good on what I know, because I know the group is not good. And I mean, I first wrote my memoir. My first memoir I wrote in 1984, and I tried to get it published, and I got some very nice replies from several publishing houses. But two of them agreed, and it was so funny because they didn't know each other. They said, "The problem with your book is that it's clear you still haven't reached resolution. You're still not sure about what you're up to." This was 1984, right? 5 years after I'd left. They said and actually I gave that manuscript to William McLaughlin, who was a named chair in the history of American religion at Brown University. I gave it to him. He read it. He wrote me a very nice 2-page single space typed letter, which was a personal letter and a review of my manuscript. And in the end, he said, "You know, when I put down your book, I said, this guy still doesn't know what hit him. It's going to take him a long time, maybe 30 years, before time and experience will show him where he's been." Well, McLaughlin was too generous. It didn't take me 30 years. It took me 45 years.
Do you feel like it was like a healing journey on some level?
Yes, yes. Because I was really in love. I mean, it's like a divorce, you know? If you really married someone, you love them, and then things go bad. I mean, you can't believe it. You feel betrayed. Yeah, I think I had a dream, you know, it's in my memoir too, it was just before I finished my first attempt in 1984. I had a dream of Mo, that I was at a school cafeteria, and suddenly it turned into a church where there was a communion bar. And Mo's children, who were very powerful leaders, one of them, whose name was Faith, who I knew, and she came in and she preached this, you know, she used to be this fiery preacher about, you've got to give it all to the Lord. You need to serve the Lord. And she came right into my dream, into this church. And I said, I know who you are. And I tried to tell all these other people, don't believe them. I was saying, they're not what they seem. And then we were all kneeling at this communion bar, and here suddenly a Mo appeared, and he was handing out communion to everybody, which never happened in the group. And I stood up and yelled at him. I said, you're a phony. You're a fraud. Get out of my life. And I woke up.
Wow, so, that's crazy. Just the idea of remembering a dream from that long ago, I can't even imagine. Do you have kids, Paul?
I do. I do. I have a wonderful daughter, and she knows about the children of God, and she's read the first. She read my first memoir. She hasn't read my second.
How old is your daughter, do you mind?
She is 33. She is a physician. I'm very proud of her. She's a doctor.
How did this experience, you think, inform your parenting approach?
Well, I happen to have a wonderful wife who is everything a mother ought to be. And I've learned so much. It's been so, I think being married to her has been a wonderful thing, because I've learned how selfish I can be. And I've learned to repent daily about it. And I've learned to be unselfish, which is a besetting sin, thinking about my own problems and my own desires all the time. And so I've tried to be unselfish and thoughtful in terms of raising our daughter. And I think she'd say I've been moderately successful.
Do you feel, if this is too personal to say so, I'm not trying to psychoanalyze, I'm just curious. Do you feel like you've had to, on some level, forgive your younger self for falling into the beliefs that you felt based on your environmental inputs?
Good question. Oh, forgiveness is a very big question. And I think it's hard sometimes. Sometimes that God will forgive you, but you won't forgive yourself, which is, so you're not going to trust God. You're going to believe you're going to beat yourself up, In one place it says, and I just read it this morning, it says in Psalm 103 that he puts our transgressions as far away from us as the east is from the west. That's how merciful he can be. So, but I think I've had to learn to forgive people that who I felt were unfair to me and the children of God. And in a way, I don't know about forgiving Mo. I think the Bible says of him, of people like that, says, Jesus, meek and mild, said, if you offend one of these little ones that believe in me, it would be better if a millstone were hung around your neck and you were thrown in the depths of the sea. That's pretty scary. In other words, the judgment that's coming your way is more to be afraid of than having a millstone put around your neck and having you thrown into the sea. It's so wrong to mislead people in the name of Christ if you did that. But, I think that judgment is mine, saith the Lord. It's not up to me to condemn him. God is more than able to do that.
Do you think he was actively misleading, though? Or do you feel like he was...
He was definitely, definitely self-deluded. He believed in what he was doing. But surely there were times in the beginning when he must have known at some point that this isn't right. The sexual liberties he took visiting prostitutes way before the thing that later developed into... At some point, his conscience was such that... I don't think he was a cynical guy, taking advantage. They say that the guy who founded Scientology said, if you really want to be a success and make money, all you do is invent a religion. And he said that, Hubbard. I don't think Mo...
Well, aren't they all invented, to some degree? What makes, I don't know, how do I say this? There's a lot of religions and there's a lot of organizations. How do you define, you reached out and said, I was part of a cult. And I'm like, whoa, crazy. I want to hear more. But when I try to think of it and try to be objective, I'm like, well, what defines that? Are all the common religions just forms of cults? Or is atheism a cult? What makes you say this is a cult as opposed to, and I don't want this to come off the wrong way, I'm not attacking your religious beliefs now. I think religion is in most cases, probably fantastic. You know, I mean, it helps you make sense of the world and live a better life. But what, why would someone, if someone was looking from Mars, just watching all this, like, why would, how would you convince them that what you believe now is not a cult, but that one was?
Well, the thing about a cult is, it, the distinguishing marks of a cult is that it actively works to stop your thinking so that you're no longer free to question. That, I mean, take Dostoevsky's attitude towards religion. He said, I'd rather, you know, I it's so important to me to believe in Christ, even though I'm filled with doubt. I you know, I'm like the guy who came to Jesus and said, I believe, Lord, help my unbelief. But such people, Dostoevsky or that guy in the New Testament, you're free to believe whatever you want. Nobody's trying to make you into one thing or another. But in a cult, once you've gotten in, there was a guy in the group who had a saying, he was a leader. If you think, you'll sink, because you stink. In other words, you can't trust yourself to think for yourself. We'll take care of you. Just trust us to show you what life's all about. In other words, it's not a matter of being free to inquire and come to your own conclusions about whether Christianity, for example, is true or not. It's once you come to us and our take on it, if you think anything else, you're compromising, you're abandoning the truth, you're doing something despicable. So the feature that is most to be criticized about cults is that in the literature, it's called bounded choice. You can't make a decision to make yourself free because everything that tends to go outside of the group is condemned. You're stuck. And unless something wakes you up, in my case, it was Jonestown, you can't get out. So that is what distinguishes a cult from, the, for example, the major religions. Let's say the major, three major Abrahamic religions, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. Is it, especially in their golden ages, is it you're free, like the, they say the rulers in Spain like to have, you know, an imam, a rabbi, and a priest come and talk to them in front of them and debate so that they can decide which is true, you know, in the golden age of Spain. And so that is why not everything is a cult. I mean, a cult can be very big. It can be North Korea, right? Where the leader of, is a god and everything he says is true and nothing. Like the poor soldiers that are sent from to help Putin fight the Ukrainians, these 12,000 poor, miserable kids, they all believe that their leader is divine. And everything he says is true. And rather than be captured by the Ukrainians, they were ordered to kill themselves first, like the poor people at Jonestown. So that's what a cult subverts your freedom to think for yourself.
That's interesting. Well, Paul, this is a fascinating story.
I hope so. I'm so familiar with it, sometimes I don't know what it is. But it did happen to me. And the lesson that I learned from it is, it's important not to stop thinking for yourself. And the thing that it takes that's important to do that is courage. And courage is not the absence of fear. It's going ahead in spite of fear to think for yourself. And for a long time, I didn't think for myself because I was afraid to. Since I've learned a little bit about thinking for myself, I realized that you've got to maintain that integrity that is not afraid, too afraid to think for yourself, even though it means people are going to disagree with you, they're going to criticize you, they may not like you. That's the price integrity has to pay to maintain itself.
Yeah, but thinking for yourself, I mean, it's like, where does that even come from? Like, on some level, I believe we're always the sum of like the cumulative momentum of all the moments that led to where we are now, like your childhood, aspects of your childhood that let you be, I don't want to say sucked in, but led you to believe that this cult was a welcoming home. So if I'm thinking for myself, I'm still just confined by all the stuff I've heard so far or contemplated that came from outside of me. So like you're always going to be influenced. Even when you're thinking for yourself, it's like it's referenced on, like, I guess you get into free will a little bit. Like when an idea emerges, is it really your unique idea? When you have a thought arise in your mind, is it really just the next step in the momentum that you already have from all your previous moments? So like you would give a story about North Korea or Russian soldiers, but, and you say that confined, like from your mind, you're critically thinking about that and you say these things like they're true and they might be, I don't know, but someone else would say something different about the very same thing. And from their mind, the space that they feel these thoughts and ideas arise, they would be just as matter of fact as you just presented your ideas. So it's like, I don't know if there's a such thing as just thinking for yourself, because I don't know where the thoughts are coming from, really. Like, is there anything that we could do that's really just coming from ourselves? Because everything we know is influenced by every interaction that we've ever had with our environment, and now with screens and the flow of information, we're affected by so much stuff. I mean, I remember during the whole COVID regime, there was indication, there was like signs of cult-like behavior in society. And is that a cult? I don't know. That's why I'm just curious. Like, I've listened to people talk about religion, and I also grew up Jewish. I don't know how you said it, like nominally, but not very religiously. And I think about religion and like the nature of reality and the purpose of why we're here and the chance, just the likelihood that Earth became what it is and how amazing it all is. And like when I'm thinking in that way, it's like, I don't know how to, and when I hear like religion discussed or try to learn about it, I'll hear two people speak about the same religion in such different ways. Like I'll hear somebody talk, like you referenced some passages from the Bible. And I've heard people talk about passages, and I know very little bit about the Bible, and maybe one day I'll do a deeper dive on that. But, you know, they're taking it literally, like everything. And I wonder, like, well, are you taking everything it says literally, or are you just taking the things that shape, that allow you to express the current thought you're trying to express literally? And then I've also heard, like, I have a acquaintance that's like a retired priest. And when I hear him talk about it, he's like, well, it's not literal. They're stories. They're analogy. Like, these are just the way that information gets passed down so that we could learn, so that we could help us, like, make sense of the world. And it doesn't mean that Adam and Eve were in a garden and there was an, like, he looks at it very differently. So is a cult him turning to somebody and saying, the way I'm thinking about it is the right way? You have to have faith in the way that I'm conveying this information. And that's, like, where is the line drawn from a cult or a non-cult organization? I find it hard to make sense in my mind, at least right now, on the limited, I've been thinking about it since you've mentioned it, that it's just your ability to think freely. Otherwise, you're considered like an outcast or wrong. I don't know where these lines are. I mean, I could make a case that there's cults all over our society.
No, I don't doubt that there are, but but your point is a good one, and it does need to be answered. And I have two or three thoughts that come to me.
Sure.
One is the possibility that some opinions are better than others. And if that's the case, there must be some standard by which one can judge that some opinions are better than others. And it suggests the possibility that there is something absolutely true and that not all things are relative. And so we're not just this. And if that's the case, what might it be? Then there's a second thought, and that is that if we are made according to, we weren't just you know, the famous German later Nazi Heidegger philosopher said we're just thrown here, you know, we don't know where we came from, we just, and so of course that's not a good analogy because that suggests a thrower. Which Heidegger, I don't think, believed it. But if we're not just thrown here, but God put us here, God made us, and that the first chapter of the Bible, however you want to read it, your priest friend, as an analogy, nonetheless, it does suggest a creator, however it happened, and that we're made in the image of God, that means that there's something about us that is steady and that can ascend from all of our diverse experiences that you said make us up to some point in which we are aware of our purpose, that there is a purpose and that we're not just thrown here, that we're not just a sum of our experiences, but there's something about us that is valuable because we're made by God. And therefore, we have a chance to, in some way, we're made to some way apprehend that. And so, in spite of all our unique experiences, we can, the idea of searching for the truth, this is why I dropped out of college when I was 19, is not wholly a description of impetuous and naive youth, but it's actually something that's made, we're made that way. So that, and so the subversion of that, the mistreatment of that, the taking advantage of that hunger, especially in the name of it, is particularly, egregious. That's why Jesus said this very strong thing about people who did that, right? Millstone and all that. So, but the thing that I would say that distinguishes cults is that somebody getting control of a group of people, it could just be a man and his wife. A man could do, a cult, I believe, could be as small as a couple, where somebody runs his wife. She has no longer any freedom to think. She just does what he says and thinks that not to do it would be a horrible thing. Or it could be as big as, you know, Stalin's Russia.
So some like power center that's imposing power over others.
Yeah, and not only imposing it, but you know, so that when Stalin died, or even when the guy, Kim Jong-un's father died, people were in tears all over Pyongyang. Why? This guy, why should you cry for him? Because they believed that they lived for him. In some way, he was everything to them. Or when Stalin died, you know? It's like you believe that this person in control is a mere human being, defines reality to such an extent that you can't go outside his circle. That's what characterizes a cult. So that you get things like Jim Jones or David Berg, or
we're just so susceptible. I mean, yeah. We all have this desire to not just fit in, but to feel like we're worthy, we're good enough in the eyes of something, our parents maybe, and you know, that could lead us to build attachments and create identities. Like it sounded like you were losing your you had to lose your identity to let yourself leave on some level, and that was really hard. You mentioned a moment ago the word purpose. I mean, do you feel that there is inherent purpose that we have as individual human beings?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I like what the English Westminster Confession, like from, I don't know, 16 something or other, Cromwell's time. Our purpose is to know God and enjoy him forever.
That sounds, at the very least, very utilitarian, like useful, whether you believe in a God or not.
Well, I think what they meant was that since he's our maker and wants to have there's a wonderful, the leading Protestant theologian that came out of post-war Germany was a guy named Helmut Tillich. He was a Lutheran. And he toured the world after the war, and he ended up having an audience with the leading Zen master in Japan in the company of another Lutheran missionary who translated. And they had an afternoon together in a tea ceremony. in which this very learned Lutheran theologian had a conversation with this very advanced Zen practitioner. And it's described in his book, Notes, in his autobiography, Notes of a Wayfarer. And the conversation, when they finally got down to the nitty-gritty, the difference between what the Buddhist master believed and what the Lutheran theologian believed was that this power, this merging, this all higher thing that's outside of us, it's just there for the Zen master. It's just there. But for the Lutheran theologian, I'm not a Lutheran, the Protestant theologian or the Christian theologian, this thing is a person, and a person is everything that we understand a person to be. And so you can have a relationship. And so that relationship, the purpose is to have that relationship. And if you do, it will change your relationship to people so that you can forgive. If your mother did you wrong, you can forgive her. I think if my sister could just forgive my mother, she would be so much happier. Forgiveness, they say that a lot of the people in mental institutions, they could just forgive those who did the wrong, wouldn't need to be there. But forgiveness is something that is so hard to do unless you've got that purpose, that you're loved by that person. And when you know you're loved, then that way, the love that won't quit, then you have the energy and the power to do everything. So that's, I definitely believe that purpose comes from knowing where you came from, and that where you came from, there's love heading your way, that he loves us. And that's so hard to believe, but it's true. That's what I believe.
Paul, I really enjoyed this conversation, and I'm glad you reached out to have it. And I think when your memoir is ready, you should let us know, and we'll let the audience know so they could hear the long version.
Wes, I've really enjoyed it. And about midway through our conversation, you reminded me of a Jewish friend I grew up with. He was actually an usher at my bar mitzvah. His name was Steve. And I looked at you, I said, Les looks like Steve. And I have such love for him, you know. He later became a physicist. But I thought, you know, especially when you told me that you were from a Jewish background. So it was a pleasure talking to you. And I thank you for your graciously allowing me to take up so much of your time.
Oh, it's been great. I think you have a great story, and there's a lot to gain for it. And I think it's admirable what you're doing, using your writing to maybe connect and reach some people that could really use that, and maybe get a reference that they could maybe see and be more self-reflective to see if they have been, I don't want to say duped, but maybe thought, you know, had someone else do their thinking for them, if you will.
Yeah.
So
I hope so.
So I appreciate it for the listeners. Always grateful for your listening. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. And if you know someone in a cult, send this their way. Have a good day, everybody.